Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and with Senator John Madigan from the Democratic Labor Party here as Senator for Victoria. I will introduce him briefly. John Madigan did an apprenticeship in structural steel fabrication at the Newport TAFE at the Victorian Railways Newport Workshops in Melbourne, and he worked as a blacksmith and a spoilermaker from 1983 until 2011. In August 2010, he was elected as a Senator for Victoria for the Democratic Labor Party, and of course his term began on the 1st of July 2011. He also holds the position of President of the DLP in Victoria and Vice President of the Federal Democratic Labor Party. And tonight, Senator Madigan's going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of integrity in politics. Senator Madigan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming. I'd like to start by thanking Gerard Henderson and the Sydney Institute for inviting me to share my thoughts on the state of our political arena with you this evening. The topic of my address this evening is integrity in politics. Some people have suggested I add "and other myths," but I've resisted that idea. I'm now in my 20th month as the first Democratic Labor Party senator to be elected in almost 40 years. And since I took my seat, I have had what could be best described as an interesting journey, etching out a place once again for the DLP in the federal political arena. For a blacksmith from Ballarat, this experience has been a steep learning curve. Over these 20 months, I've slowly found my bearings, and with the never-ending patience of the Senate staff, I eventually come to have a decent understanding of the processes and procedures which are essential to the functioning of the Senate and the government. Of these learning experiences, some have been helpful, some inspiring, and others frankly disappointing. Among the helpful have been the assistance and approaches of a handful of fellow senators such as Nick Xenophon and Nigel Scullion. Most of the inspiring experiences have come from constituents, many of whom are genuine battlers and others who dedicate their time and energy to assisting others with no expectation of reward. The disappointing aspects are almost exclusively tied to the topic of my talk today. Virtually everyone can be put down to what I consider a lack of integrity in our political system. Integrity, as I see it, is being truthful to yourself. Honesty is being truthful to others. When asked about integrity in public life, Frederick Douglass, an escaped slave who became a leader of the abolitionist movement and the first African-American candidate for the Vice President of the United States in 1872, said, "I prefer to be true to myself, even at the hazard of incurring the ridicule of others, rather than to be false and to incur my own abhorrence." Integrity is vital for good governance and good representation, and yet some of the more cynical political manoeuvring in both houses of Parliament and in the back room undermines the very practice of democracy. To many, the notion of integrity is seen as a weakness in others that should be exploited. In my first speech to the Senate, I paid tribute to the principles of the first DLP senators. In a time of trial, they were courageous enough to bear the ostracising of their contemporaries for daring to stand up for a principle. Such courage was rare then, but the virtue of integrity and ethical behaviour is at the present time thin on the ground. I am not suggesting that the DLP is faultless or has a history of unimpeachable integrity. On the contrary, there were times when we acted in a similar matter, similar to other parties, putting self-interest before duty. Coming into the Senate as the most outside of outsiders, a tradesman and a member of the Democratic Labor Party, an oddity and a leper, I was quickly educated and simultaneously frustrated at processes that were deemed by those already incumbent as normal practice or protocol, yet were, I believe, tarnishing the democratic process. Politics is about people, or should be. After all, that's what we are supposed to be in this for, to represent the people of our electorates, our states and our country. Unfortunately, this view, still in hope more than in belief by the Australian populace, is not held in the hearts of many politicians today. Supporting the desires, needs or rights of our constituents seems more and more to come a distant second to the will of the party machine. I know I'm not telling you anything that you do not already know, but that's the point. This is known to you, the media, and it's known to the people of Australia. The trick in politics is to never let the two bring it to a head. Your job in the media is not only to report what we are up to, but to give voice to the people. Or as Frederick Douglass put it, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. As the sole senator for a political party without the balance of power, yet I am usually left out of most party conversations, and that's understandable. The two or the three party machines speak with their own language, and it's not one that I'm fluent in. But while those party machines babble on in their mechanical, emotionless chatter, the occasional wandering senator, a spare part loose from one or the other of the machines, will approach and admit they envy my position. Me, alone, with little power, minimal resources, and regularly ignored and envied by those who stride the halls of Parliament like lords of the earth. And why? Almost without exception, they will state, because I have a will of my own. I can support my constituents, make a speech, move a bill or a motion that is not something churned out or pre-approved by the inner workings of their emotionless machine. Yes, they have principles, but these are too often subordinated to the will of the machine. And to subordinate one's principles for the base objectives of another is soul-destroying. If a candidate for election cannot stand on their principles before an election, they will never do so after their election. And if they cannot stand on them while in office, what good are they? The DLP, as you all know, is a pro-life party. And for those of us who for decades have fought for justice for the unborn, it galls me to watch political candidates strut around seeking votes from pro-life groups, only to hear their entourage proclaiming platitudes such as, "Just wait until so-and-so gets in. They're staying quiet now, but when they are in, they'll sort things out." Then the aptly named so-and-so is elected, having kept quiet about their principles, and the excuses start. Oh, now is not the time. We have to pick our moment. Patience is a virtue, etc. Then every third year, here they come to start the process over again. This time they say, "We've got it all planned out. Just get back in and watch us go." To those politicians, I reserve my utmost disgust. There is no integrity in them, and integrity in others is not seen as a virtue, but a tool to be used for their convenience. To any voter who falls for that again and again, I remind them of the saying, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." In this, I must admit, and not without distress, you can't fault the Greens. Their principles, while far removed on so many levels from my own, are known before an election, and you can be sure they'll act on them once they're in. I'm not here to be anyone's friend. I'm here to represent the people of Victoria to the best of my ability, honestly and fairly, and yes, with integrity. If I get every other parliamentarian offside by sticking to the principles that brought me here, then so be it. Neither I nor the DLP will be bought, nor will I play the game of secrets so popular with many party machines. I do not know how long I will be here. If it's up to many of my fellow senators, it won't be long. But when I do eventually leave, I intend to go with my soul intact. And when it comes to integrity versus the party machine, there are any number of examples I could go into, but I will restrict it to this one for now. Late last year, I moved a condolence motion on the death of an asylum seeker activist and ALP member, Vicky Riley, who was killed in a bicycle accident in Darwin on September the 10th, 2012. In consultation with Miss Riley's family, I worded the motion to recognise the work she had done with asylum seekers and for the East Timorese and West Papuan people. The coalition voted against the motion. The ALP senators were directed to vote against the motion for one of their own members because of the mention of West Papua. The motion did not call for support for West Papua or West Papuan independence. It did not heap condemnation on the Indonesian government, nor did it raise any issues of human rights violations. It simply mentioned West Papua as one of the many causes which Vicky Riley supported. The motion was defeated. Only 8 senators voted to honour the life of a caring Australian and express condolence to her family, friends and those she worked for, myself, Senator Xenophon and the Greens. Where did it get Senator Crossan, who acknowledged her collaboration with Miss Riley, but who out of loyalty to the machine voted against the motion? She has been dumped from her Senate position in favour of a more marketable candidate. This may appear to be a small matter, but central to this motion was a respect for the dignity of the person and the contribution Miss Riley had made to her community. The machine subordinates the principles once again. A topic with broader national impact, and one you probably already know, regards a bill on electoral reform now before the Senate. Among various amendments, the bill calls for a 100% increase in nomination fees for federal election candidates. Needless to say, with only 7 months to an election, this was not good news for the minor parties. I raised the matter with the government and the opposition. The Greens had an amendment prepared which would remove the increase in nomination fees. I assumed that it was unlikely to get up and put a motion to allow the increases, but to bring them in by 25% a year over 4 years, then increasing the fees on an annual basis according to the CPI. They would get their increase and the miners and the independents would have time to prepare. Almost immediately I got good news. The opposition was willing to support the amendment. Then a day later I was advised that they'd reconsidered. I can only assume they realised that the Greens would also support it, and with the amendment getting up, would not have the debilitating effect on the minor parties they desired. At this point, I decided to get the opinion of other minor parties and called almost half of those currently registered on the AEC website. Parties as diverse as the Australian Christians, Socialist Alliance, the Greens, One Nation, the Liberal Democracy Party and Family First. Without fail, everyone stated this unannounced increase was clearly a deliberate attack on their ability to participate in the next election. Along with the Greens, these parties represent somewhere between 22 to 25% of the voters across Australia, yet virtually none of them, the DLP included, receive any funding from the Electoral Commission. I advised the government, the opposition and the media that this would not be forgotten by any of the parties when the majors came on their three-year prowl for preferences. It was at this point that I was approached by a member of the government and advised that the electoral reforms could include the introduction of an administration funding in the order of $1 per national vote. This funding would be available for the parties elected in 2010 and that would more than likely commence from March 2013. As the DLP has received some 140,000 votes, we would be entitled to receive $1 for each of those votes to be paid in quarterly instalments over my six-year Senate term. Only those elected would receive this funding, leaving the other minor parties high and dry again, competing against the ALP, Coalition and the Greens, who would under this scheme rake in something like $12 to $15 million between them. The electoral reform report does not mention intention to offer administration funding based on a suggestion by the New South Wales Greens, but it sets out no details and stated the minor parties would be consulted before forming any detailed plan. Now, here was a final plan. I assume legislation was ready to be put into the House of Reps, but as yet, with no consultation and with no benefit to any minor party except the DLP, as the new boy in an exclusive club. Imagine the position I and the DLP would be in if that legislation appeared and I voted to accept it. With what I assume will be the same obscene haste the majors approach any bill providing them with financial benefit, I would be turning our back on the democratic principles I promised to defend in the name of every party from the Christian Democrats to the Socialist Alliance. How, in God's name, can this situation continue? After the last election, the ALP received some $21 million. The Coalition received some $23 million and the Greens received just over $7 million. I'm not complaining about that. These are the rules, and under those rules, these parties were entitled to share the $51 million of taxpayers' money between them. Truth is, I'd love the DLP to have received a little funding, but we didn't qualify. So now we have a situation where the three larger parties share $51 million or so from election funds, but decide that they also need to share another $12 million or so for their party administration. The DLP party administration doesn't quite have the same problem because we don't have a single paid employee. But if we did have paid party workers, we wouldn't expect the taxpayers to fork out more money just to keep us running. I think a simple solution to this would be for the 220-odd MPs and senators of the ALP, Coalition and the Greens parties to take the hefty pay rises they gave themselves last year and put that toward their party's administration. I estimate that they would only have to contribute half their pay rise over 3 years of the parliament to meet these costs. I should state that the Greens voted against the pay rises, so they would probably have no problem using the money for this purpose, but I doubt the Coalition or the ALP would agree. If your administration and electoral costs are blowing out, then that is your problem, not the taxpayers. If your administration... Scrooge complained about employees picking their employees' pockets every 25th of December, and just imagine how the Australian people feel about having their employees do it to them 365 days a year. What these matters highlight, that in today's Parliament, pragmatics trumps integrity. Last Friday, I went to the Donald Primary School in Cantrell, Victoria, and I'm in the habit of taking my portable forge with me to regional schools and giving the children a quick demonstration of blacksmithing and of the enjoyment that comes from working a trade. As usual, the kids were enthralled, and despite the school day closing at 3:30, many kids called home to tell their parents, grandparents they would be staying behind to make an S-hook. These occasions give me the opportunity to meet the parents and grandparents of the children to demonstrate the skills of what Senator Evans referred to as an obsolete trade, and also to give me the chance to see what problems both the school and the local community are having. The Donald Primary School is an example of countless other schools across our country. This school, over a century old, riddled with borer, with windows that can't open, with teachers coming in on their days off to paint the classrooms, with the local community banding together to raise money for equipment and buildings and much needed work, and with a principal who gives his own time and money in an attempt to give his kids a shot at a decent future. This is our education system, held together by our greatest asset, community. So when I see a bunch of self-satisfied politicians who vote themselves a pay rise greater than some people's yearly wage, who get $50 million or more of taxpayers' money just for getting elected, and who now decide they need another $15 million or so to keep their precious parties in the style to which they are accustomed, I'm ashamed to be called one of them. Integrity in politics. Maybe another myth was correct after all. Fundamental to all DLP policies is respect for the dignity of the human person. This belief is what informs all of our policies, from the right of workers through to the right to life of all human beings. It is this, I believe, that makes our policies appear contradictory in the common political divisions of left and right. We might be correctly assessed as conservative in the area of social policy and progressive when it comes to industrial relations and economics. In the area of workers' rights, we support the roles of trade unions in collective bargaining. It is a great fiction that an under-resourced individual worker can engage in bargaining for his or her rights with a richly resourced company that has the services of legal and HR professionals. In any other circumstances, such a situation would be seen as bullying. This year, I'm introducing several bills I hope will increase the rights of workers, encourage our manufacturing and farming sectors. The first of these, a series of fair trade bills, will be introduced in a few weeks. The Fair Trade Workers' Rights Bill is aimed at limiting imports from countries which we have a free trade agreement, but whose workers do not get basic workers' rights. Australian employers pay work cover, superannuation, holiday pay, and a myriad of other things. They cannot be expected to compete on a supposed level playing field with countries whose workers have few, if any, rights. I also hope to introduce details of a long-held DLP policy for a personal leave insurance scheme, enabling employees to take their sick leave and carers leave with them from employer to employer, while not burdening the new employer with any further costs. In the area of social policy, there are some ugly things which happen in the halls of Parliament, where many simply turned a blind eye to inconvenient matters. The absurd situation over the condolence motion for Vicky Riley highlights this hypocrisy. On an equally serious matter, there is a small cohort of members and senators who, when they are put to the test, will claim they are pro-life. Unfortunately, they rarely introduce adequate legislation and secretly wish it would not raise its ugly head. Without a murmur from them on essential issues of life and death, which underpin our whole understanding of human rights, bills pass. This applies across political lines. Perhaps only the Greens can be said to be consistently in favour of ending life. There does not appear to be a similar cohort aimed at preserving life. Recently, the federal leader of the opposition, Tony Abbott, repeated that he would like abortion to be safe, legal and rare, an aim shared by Barack Obama in his second inauguration speech. However, I would like to point out there is no such thing as a safe abortion. Someone always dies. I would also agree with the US commentators on President Obama's statement when they state that while the legal part has been fulfilled, it's rare that it seems to elude public policy. This is a view shared by a sexual revolution pioneer, Bettina Arndt, who a year ago wrote about the advances made under the Howard government, increasing the availability of long-acting contraceptives and the legalising of the importation of RU486. I do not agree with the latter, but I do agree when she wrote, and I quote, "How ironic that Australia now has its second female federal health minister. And despite this, Gillard's government shows no interest in improving the sorry state of Australia's fertility control. Australia has one of the highest abortion rates in the world." Whatever one's views on pregnancy termination, she writes, it is shocking that each year between 70,000 and 90,000 women face the stress of abortion. But Tina Arndt has the honesty to admit that abortion is stressful to women. And indeed, a report in the Journal of Perinatal Medicine concludes that for some women, it can lead beyond stress to anxiety, depression, alcohol and drug abuse, and suicidal behaviours. Miss Arndt quotes from research from Murray Stopes International, incidentally Australia's biggest abortion services provider, that 51% of Australian women haven't experienced an unplanned pregnancy and 40% of those were not using contraception. Again, I disagree with Miss Arndt when she says a woman's right to abortion must be protected, but find myself agreeing wholeheartedly with her qualification that it is unconscionable for governments not to make every effort to help women avoid abortion. Mr. Abbott has expressed a desire for abortion to be safe, legal and rare, and as Health Minister in the Howard government did take some steps towards offering impartial counselling from services other than abortion providers. The Gillard government has shown no interest in moving towards making abortion rare. Indeed, in some parliamentary circles, promoting abortion appears to be a badge of honour. We might look at the behaviours surrounding the legislation of the importation of RU486, both in its passage through Parliament in February 2006 and more recently with the announcement that it would be imported into Australia by a pharmaceutical company, Murray Stopes Health, established by Australia's biggest abortion services provider, Murray Stopes International, for the sole purpose of importing RU486. Although it was before my time, I've read the reports that the mood of the supporters of that legislation after its passage was euphoric, and that some RU486 supporters were reprimanded by the President of the Senate for gloating behaviour by entering the Senate with celebratory flutes of champagne. On October the 10th, 2012, another celebration of RU486 was held in the House. This time it was to celebrate the Therapeutic Goods Administration approval for Murray Stopes Health to distribute RU486 in Australia. The gathering, sponsored by the Parliamentary Group for Population and Development and chaired by Liberal Senator Sharman Stone, hailed the availability of RU486 as a triumph of bipartisanship. Lynn Ellison of the former Democrats and patron of Murray Stopes noted that RU486 bill was the second private member's bill to pass both Houses of Parliament and had support from four political parties. ALP Senator Claire Moore spoke of the purpose of the bill to have RU486 treated like any other medicine, never mind that it doesn't treat any illness. And of course, it was launched by the Health Minister, Tanya Plibersek, who had a great pleasure in launching this important step. There are a few incongruities in this event, which occurred five and a half years after the passage of the legislation. The obvious one is that no pharmaceutical company sought to import the drug. Could this be due to the risks involved in administering such a drug? Certainly, there is a danger to women. And even the obstetrician and RU486 supporter, Dr. Carolyn DaCosta, warns that it should not be administered in remote areas where access to hospital care is unavailable. The second is that the country's largest abortion provider, Murray Stopes International, now known by the caring title of Dr. Murray, had to establish a new pharmaceutical company for the sole purpose of importing an abortifacient drug. Surely one has to ask whether there is a conflict of interest here. Where are the checks and balances? Should a company that administers the only late-term abortion clinic in Victoria, where there has been one documented death and one case of organ failure in a woman undergoing an abortion, be trusted to work in the best interests of women? Here we have an extraordinary display of bipartisanship from the abortion lobby. Where is the pro-life political lobby? Are any of them even aware of these conversations taking place? Where is their commitment to the cause? I know that many will want to excuse my comments on account of my Catholicism. Being Catholic is not a prerequisite for being pro-life. Many people, including Christians of various denominations, profess a pro-life ethos, as do most Muslims. It may have been true in the past that God, and therefore one's religious principles, had preeminence over family and country, but with the current cries for separation of church and state, we are perhaps in a situation where if one has a religious conviction, they will be asked to check it in at the door. A person of religious or ethical conviction is seen as a liability in politics. Secular pragmatism is Trump's, but being right is not a statistical average. As Frederick Douglass said, and I'll end with his words, "The man who is right is a majority. He who has God and conscience on his side has a majority against the universe." Thank you.
Many thanks, Senator Madigan. So we come to question and discussion. We've got plenty of time, so and we'll finish either at or before 7 o'clock. I think I heard you correctly when you said in your talk that the Democratic Labor Party, which is you in the Senate, didn't have the balance of power yet. And I think that's a fair statement, because obviously there is either a possibility or perhaps a remote possibility or something like that of you having the balance of power with someone else or on your own after the new Senate comes in on the 1st of July 2014. So Tony Abbott, as you know, has said that if he happens to be Prime Minister by then and his attempts to get rid of the carbon tax or the emissions trading scheme or whatever it's then called is thwarted in the Senate, that he would go for a double dissolution. Can you just tell us what your position is on the carbon tax, on the emissions trading scheme, and how this reflects what you feel is the feedback you get from the people who elect you in the state of Victoria?
On the carbon tax and emissions trading scheme, the DLP, I will hold Tony Abbott to his word. The DLP and I believe that the carbon tax and an emissions trading scheme, or whatever genre you want to put it in, is not in the interests of Australia, Australians, families, farmers, our workers, communities, our manufacturers. The people that I speak to, people on the ground, have no problem whatsoever with looking after the environment, finding smarter ways to use energy. To give you an example, I was talking to a farmer the other day and he said, "I'm more than happy to put a more efficient electric motor on my irrigation pump because it's going to save me money." And that's what we'll be, you know, promoting with the government, and that's what the government's gone to their people with, and that's what we will hold them to.
So, right, so question down the back, and then one up the front. Yep.
Just a follow-up to that question. Where do you stand on climate change? Do you believe in it or not?
Look, I believe there's climate change. What I'm not convinced on is whether man, the effect of man on the climate. But look, if quite frankly, if there wasn't climate change, you know, there'd still be dinosaurs running around. So the fact of the matter is, the climate has changed.
Hang on just a second. We're taking one question at a time. Could you keep staying, stay here, and then we'll come back to that. There's a question here. Yeah.
I went to the Christian Brothers at Lewisham, where Trilby left school. I left school in 1955 to vote Labor, joined the union, and support the Labor Party. I put to you that Victoria is slightly different to New South Wales. Cardinal Gilroy would not let the National Civic Council sell their papers and Newsweek out in church grounds. They used to flog it outside the street. My father always voted Labor. All my uncles did, even though they were millionaires and meat processors. I think Victoria is different to New South Wales. Thank you.
What he's saying is, all the Catholics vote Labor up here. That's what he's saying, I
think. Not all. Except Tony Abbott.
Except the blokes
he went to Riverview.
Except
the, ones went,
except the ones who rent to Riverview. That's what he's saying. Okay. A response from Ballarat. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with you because I know many people in New South Wales who are supporters of the DLP, have been in the past, are presently and will be into the future. What I would say to you is that, we do not bear the ALP any ill will or malice. We wish the ALP to return to the true values of the Labor movement that were held by Ben Chifley.
Just stay there. Just stay here. Okay. Don't walk away. There's a question. Here. Don't stand in front of the camera yet. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Go on.
You'd be interested to know that in 1964, there were a lot of people that voted for the DLP that elected the first state Labor government. That was in 1964. All down through Illawarra. All those seats were won by activists. Some of us in this room now. We handed out paperwork for the DLP as before you were in court, and that's when they won the DLP elected state government, the Liberal government, in 1964.
So you know you're blamed for electing the Liberal government. I think it was in 1965. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, Stuart,
how do you find the processes and procedures in the Senate, considering that? Hardly have any staff or anything like that in going through bills and such work type thing. How do you find that?
Well, it has proved difficult, but one thing I've got, the staff that I've got are 100% committed. They want to enhance Australia. They want to make people's lives better. And we take the job extremely seriously. My staff do too, and they wouldn't have been chosen unless they did. And they have complementary skills, and they come from different angles. And I think that's a great asset to me to have those complementary views and people coming from different angles.
How do you get on with how helpful are the leaders of the ALP and the coalition in the Senate? And the Greens, do you have much cooperation with any of them?
As far as the Greens go, well, look, there is next to no discussion. something that, I believe there's good people in all parties. There's people of principles. But I think the disconnect comes from the machine and the people, the grassroots people, that there becomes so much self-interest and this lust for power that the true aims of people who genuinely want to conserve our environment and look after it, the people who want to look after the rights of workers, the people who want to advocate for business, there's a disconnect between the real people and the political process. That's the thing that I lament the most.
Now we go there and over here. Yeah. Senator, your very sensible comments about farmers understanding the environment and caring about it and on that climate change alarmism. Do you have a view on the Murray-Darling Basin and the Water Act?
When it came before the Senate recently, there was only two senators that abstained from the vote, and they were myself and Bill Heffernan from here in New South Wales. Last Tuesday afternoon, I drove to Wagga Wagga, and I had a meeting in Albury on Tuesday night, followed by a meeting of farmers at Collin Gully, which is just west of Wagga. And I have a connection to Wagga through my extended family, and our national president happens to have a farm just near Collin Gully. Having travelled around northern Victoria extensively, speaking to people, what I fear most is that if the Murray-Darling Basin Plan were to deliver the objectives that the government, the Greens, say it will, that's one thing. But who are we saving the environment for if we're not saving it for people and the communities that live in the environment? The plans, we had the New South Wales Office of Heritage and Environment, I think they call themselves, there last week. And what my experience has been pre-politics and reinforced post-politics is that a lot of things are brought out into the public and they go through a process of so-called public consultation. My experience has been that it's just a tick and a flick, that they've already made up their mind and they just want to give people this appearance of public consultation. Well, you know, public servants are not public masters. They're there to serve the people, not the people serve them.
Lindsay.
I'll ask two questions in case the answer to the first one is very short. In your lifetime in Victoria, did you ever have anything to do with Bob Santa Maria? And if so, what are your memories of him? The second one is between the demise of the DLP in the mid-70s and your election, we had the fall of communism in the late 80s, early 90s. Those of us who remember the DLP senators remember that anti-communism was a big thing. How do you approach foreign affairs now with China being a major trading partner, with socialism having taken over from communism in many of these countries? Is there a particular approach?
Can you repeat the question?
Okay, well, the questions were, did Senator Manigan ever meet, and whether he did or not, what do you think of Bob Santa Maria? And the second question is that the old DLP was very much focused on anti-communism. This has now changed with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the emergence of China as a socialist rather than a communist regime, and what's your attitude on foreign policy?
When I was growing up, my sister and I were both members of Bob Santa Maria's youth group in Melbourne. I never actually spoke to Bob Santa Maria, and I was one of the larger ticket sellers for the NCC in the Bonanza fundraiser for quite a number of years.
That's right.
And but to elaborate a bit further, I think people need to be crystal clear. Bob Santa Maria was never a member of the DLP. First point. The second point is that the National Civic Council in today's genera did nothing to help my election as a DLP senator.
And the foreign policy bit?
And as far as the fall of communism goes, yes, the DLP was a strident in its opposition to communism, but, you know, despots, people who put it over people, the names may change, the characters may change, but human nature does not change. And those people, those ideologies dressed up in whatever shape or form still exist today in one shape or form or another. There are still people out there who want to put it over people, and the DLP is vigilant against those people.
Yes, sir. Senator Madigan, renewable energy is something that's a bit of a catchphrase these days. You've done a bit of work and you've spoken and written on questions like wind farms and so on. What's been your conclusion of the work you've done? And tell us about a bit of that work you've done around the nation. You've been very active in that area.
At home, Ballarat, just outside of Ballarat, for instance, we have the Warbra wind farm, which is one of the largest wind farms in the country. My position is, and the DLP's position is, that we have no problem with renewable energy, but renewable energy that is affordable, renewable energy that respects communities, renewable energy that does no harm to people. The situation in Victoria is that we have people who are leaving their homes. We have people who are absolutely distraught. I might add, these people are not, I stress, they are not political activists. They are people who are just hard-working people who are being driven from their homes. Now, the fact of the matter is that the companies, the proponents of these wind farm developments, case in point, will not, and I stress, will not supply the data so that independent acousticians can check that they comply with the legislation under which the permits were granted. Now, I would think, I believe any reasonable person would think that, you know, if you are so-called compliant, in inverted commas, you'd be tripping over yourself to put the necessary information in the public domain to verify your claims. Last year, just 7-8 months ago, I presented a report that people in Warbra commissioned of an independent acoustician, and I presented it to the Minister for Planning in Victoria, Mr. Matthew Guy. I had a discussion with him for some 30 minutes or so and was told that, you know, the Minister was going to look into it. Well, look into it like a mirror. I've phoned the Minister on numerous occasions, as have my staff. The Minister is unable, unwilling to return my call. Meanwhile, people are being driven from their homes. Now, the fact of the matter is also that there is tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, if the truth be known, that is paid in renewable energy certificates to these wind farms. The fact is, I'm not asking for retrospective legislation. All I'm asking for them is to be held to account like any other business in this country is. And an example of this is any other industry in this country is subject to background noise plus 5 dBA. I put a bill in with Senator Nick Xenophon in the Senate, excessive noise bill for renewable energy, and we were very, we weren't conservative, we were very liberal. In the bill we said background noise plus 10 dBA. And for anybody who knows anything about acoustics, it's a big jump from 5 to 10. So we're being very liberal in our approach to this, you know, because we understand people still think they're great, they're green, they're all of this. Well, I think the verdict's still out, and our power prices, I might add, are going through the roof. So as an economic argument, there's certainly a social argument, and there's an environmental argument that is yet to be answered.
Senator, you've said that you were planning to introduce legislation, trade protection on certain imports where there's no cost of production for labour. My question is that wouldn't that cause trade retaliation and also higher costs for manufacturers of other industries? You will lose more jobs than protect. Thank you.
Well, nowhere did I mention the word protection. What I'm saying is that there's a so-called level playing field. And the level playing field, like governments in this country legislate, they tax Australian businesses. Australian companies comply with that. Well, our competitors do not. So there is no level playing field. As much as we will all talk about level playing fields, that's a fallacy, an absolute fallacy. Now, you know, it's ironic
that in this day and age where we've got people with mobile phones, iPads, personal computers, split system air conditioners, flat screen colour TVs, the very thing that the most people yearn for, and that is the ability to buy a home, is becoming further and further out of the reach of the ordinary Australian. So since we've privatised, and there has, you know, possibly been some good privatisation, but I think, you know, if you have a look at it and check around and see what we've got, the bang for our buck, it hasn't delivered socially, it hasn't delivered economically, and it hasn't delivered environmentally.
There's a question in the back corner there.
And Senator, you've spoken about the party machine, particularly in the two major parties. What can we, as the average punter in New South Wales, do in relation to that machine and to allow principles to come out once again?
As I said, you know, I'm very disillusioned with the party machines that exist. I'd encourage all people, no matter what their view, which side of politics they are, to become involved. Whether it's the ALP, the Nationals, the Liberals, the Greens, Christian Dems, the DLP, Family First or whatever. You know, we need people of goodwill to engage in the political process. We can't leave that ground open to people that want to distort our values and what we all yearn for in Australia.
There was a question there, and then we'll come here. Yeah, yeah, don't stand up. Yeah.
Yes.
No, don't stand up.
Oh, don't stand up. All right. Yes, it's July 2014. We got over the big surprise of Karen Appel being made Pope.
Okay.
But you have now got the balance of power in the Senate. Legislation for a revised work choices have come up to the Senate from the lower house, which is appropriate safeguards now for employees.
Okay, I think we got it. The question is, how would you vote if there was a revised... A move by a coalition government to bring back in work choices, if there were?
As far as work choices goes, I won't be voting for work choices. But what I will be pushing for is that the majority of employers are reputable employers. They need to hold the disreputable employers to account. And the mirror of that is that the reputable unionists need to hold the disreputable unionists to account. And people need to work for the common good. You know, it's amazing in this country that we hold up sports people as being heroes. Well, people who provide employment, pay work cover, pay superannuation and do the right thing, they should be held up as heroes. And people in the union movement who strive for honesty, accountability and fair representation of the worker, they should be held up too as heroes. So we need to stop this adversarial relationship and get on with what's in the best interest of Australia and all Australians, business, unions and the worker and the employer.
Next question here.
Listening to what you want to do and believe in and whatever, you sound remarkably similar to Family First. We had Family First speak for us a few years ago. Are you in any way connected with any of those groups in the sense that you want a more family-orientated kind of social policy and fair deal and all of that? Was it Steve Fielding? You say some of the things that Steve Fielding said. I just wonder if you've had any connection with them and whether they support you in any way, even though you may have defeated him in the Senate election.
There's no doubt that Family First may say some similar things to us, but the point is that, you know, the DLP has been consistent in its approach and its advocacy since its inception at the split. We haven't sold out our principles, we won't sell out our principles, and we're not for sale. As far as Family First goes, as with all minor parties, I'm happy to speak to anybody. You know, we may agree, we may not agree, but every person has the right to their opinion. you know, but, you know, I think, you know, if people really look at what the DLP's policy position and advocacy is, that there is a distinct difference.
Final question. As you know, you won last time, so you're not coming up at the next election. Is the DLP running in Victoria? If you are, who's your candidate and what sort of chance would he or she have?
We are running Senate teams around the country, as we have done consistently for many years. Our lead Senate candidate in Victoria, who also happens to be our state president, and our federal secretary, is Mark Farrell. Mark's from Bacchus Marsh, just out between Melbourne and Ballarat. Mark's got a young family. He also is a manufacturer of organic fertilisers for the turf horticulture industries, a self-made person. But as we were last night, we were together after a talk last night by Christopher Monckton, and Mark and I were speaking, and Mark told me how his grandfather, his father's father, used to go to meetings, and at one union meeting, for instance, he went and asked some questions, and he said, "My grandfather had the daylights beaten out of him." So Mark's direct link to what happened, some of the more unsavoury things, is very present. He's an honest person, he tells it as it is, and he won't mislead people, and he won't tell you what you want to hear, he'll just tell it as it is.
Many thanks. Just step aside for a second. Well, many thanks to Senator John Madigan. It was a forthright and strong talk, and we've taken half an hour of questions and discussion and covered a lot of ground. I guess it's true to say that not many Australians expected Senator Madigan to get up last time, but he did, and he's making a presence, as we've seen here tonight. All the senators are, as any politician would know, every senator's got one vote, and they're all pretty important, and after the 1st of July 2014, you may be more important. But we're grateful for you to come along, stating your position across a range of social, political, economic issues on the general issue of integrity in politics. Thanks for tonight, and we'll have you back sometime in the future, but well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.